From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The Church of Scientology is under the microscope after former members have criticized the legitimacy of the organization. Today on the program, we'll examine religious cults with Professor Nikki Bado Frelick of Iowa State University. Then I'll be joined by Carolyn Jessup. She's the author of the 2007 New York Times bestselling memoir, Escape. The book details the story of her harrowing escape with her 8 children from an extremist Mormon sect. Jessup's latest book is titled Triumph, Life After the Cult, A Survivor's Lessons. Do you have a personal experience with a cult that you'd like to share? Join our conversation after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you could join us over the noon hour of this rainy day. Religious sects and cults are part of our landscape. They surface regularly in our news and have a long history in our country. That's why this hour we want to take a closer look at cults, what defines them, and how do they get such a grip on their members. We also want to ask which cults are in our midst at present. Later in the hour, Carolyn Jessup will join us, author of the 2007 New York Times bestselling memoir, Escape. The book details the story of her harrowing escape with her 8 children from an extremist Mormon sect. Jessup's latest book is titled Triumph, Life After the Cult, A Survivor's Lessons. First of all, for our first half hour, joining us, Nikki Bado of Iowa State University, an associate professor of religious studies, director of the religious studies program at ISU, and she joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. Good afternoon.
Hi, Ben.
How do we define a cult? The defining characteristics are?
I'm glad you asked that question. This comes up in most of the classes that I teach, especially when I talk about religions in America, and I address the many new religious movements that have their roots within the United States. Cult is officially defined as a religion that revolves around a charismatic leader and worships a particular god or a particular set of gods. By that definition, of course, Christianity is one of the most successful cults in the world.
Right.
But the way that we use cult in an ordinary sense is as somebody else's religion that scares us or makes us uncomfortable or challenges us. Somebody's religion that we're not too sure about. For example, I'm quite sure that my students would not get a very welcome reception to calling home to mom and dad and saying, "Hi, mom. Hi, dad. Things are going great here at the university. I need a little bit more money for books this semester. And oh, by the way, I joined a cult." That probably wouldn't go over.
Right. It's a loaded word. How is cult different than a sect, or is it different?
Usually, they're not that different, right? If you look at the official definition of the way that cult and sect are used within the academy, but when you get out into the world of everyday people, right? Cult takes on a rather more sinister aspect than sect or denomination, because it seems to imply the kind of authoritarian rule that Carolyn Jessup, of course, documented in her book.
Mm-hmm. So it's this element of control. When we're a member of a religious group, we pay attention to the mores of the group, the values of mm-hmm. the group, and behave accordingly. So it's the idea of controlling members on a much larger scale, mentally, mm-hmm. physically?
Yes. Mentally, physically, emotionally, controlling what they can read, controlling what they can see, whether they can watch television, whether they can go to a public school, whether they can read outside material, either in print or online, whether they have access to different ideas in the world.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we know that cults can be extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. We all have to think back to the 1978 mass suicide at Jonestown in Guyana, led to the deaths of over 900 people. Jim Jones People's Temple cult. So what forces are at work that give cults such a strong hold on their members?
In terms of what exactly?
Well, here we had a mass suicide of over 900 people in that case. What strings do you have a hold of on a person that would drive them to this?
Well, in the case of the People's Temple, I think one of the strings or many of the strings are rooted in the emotional and psychological need that people have for community. I mean, from what I understand, sometimes people whom we later identify as cult leaders, you know, they pick up on people's insecurity. They pick up on people who are down and out. They offer them comfort. They offer them emotional support. They may offer them food, housing. They may offer them protection. All of these things are things that people need and people want. And so it's kind of easy, I think, to then make the jump from I'm getting my emotional needs and my psychological needs and maybe my physical needs being met by this community to only these people will provide for me. And I have to do what they want me to do in order to stay a member of the community. There are, you know, historically there have been various psychological tools that leaders have used to get people in a place where they can be manipulated. In Carolyn Jessup's case, it seems that, you know, she was born into this community. And when you're born into this community, the cards are definitely stacked against you. How do you get out? Mm-hmm. How do you get access to different ways of looking at the world? It's very difficult.
That's precisely a question we'll ask her about in the mm-hmm. second half hour. What would you say are the best known cults active in the present in the U.S.?
Active cults, oh boy, that's a very loaded question, because of course one person's cult is another person's religion, and how dare you slander us by calling us a cult? Certainly, in the news has been Scientology.
Right.
Recently, and whether or not Scientology is a cult or a religion, and to what extent members are coerced and are they intimidated and so forth, and that's been all out in the news. It's controversial not only in America but also in Germany and in other countries. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one that probably readily comes to mind.
So as a professor of religious studies, mm-hmm. What is your opinion after sizing up the information on the Church of Scientology in the U.S. right now, these recent reports of physical abuse within the organization? Is it a cult, in your opinion?
I think we have to have more evidence coming out. And I think that that's going to be played out on the very large stage of not just American public opinion, but also on the stage of courts and the kinds of judgments that lawyers will be making.
Mm-hmm. Is Scientology active in Iowa that you know of?
I don't know of a very large presence in Iowa, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we need to, how should we say, be afraid of the Scientologist hiding under our bed at night.
Right, but if someone is a member of the Church of Scientology, knowing what you know about the church, will you as a friend or an acquaintance or a workmate necessarily know?
I have a very good friend who married a man back in Ohio who was a Scientologist, and she converted to Scientology after she married him. And I wonder about how she's doing from time to time. I haven't kept in touch with her since I moved to Iowa, but when she lived in Ohio, she seemed to have a fairly happy relationship and seemed to have accomplished a lot of things that she wanted to accomplish in her life. So to some extent, I think you can see that even things that we are religions that we're suspicious of or that we're a little bit nervous about can do good things for people.
Mm-hmm. I want to reach out to our listeners to have them join our conversation for this hour as we talk about cults, and we know that's a fuzzy word, religious sects. Do you have a personal experience with a cult or a potentially dangerous religious sect that you'd like to share? Do you worry that someone in your life is involved with a cult? Share your story this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Are cults a particularly American phenomenon?
Oh, no. No, I don't think so. I think that wherever you see new religious movements, which is what scholars tend to want to call this these phenomena, whenever you see new religious movements happening, they tend to stir the pot. They offer a challenge to the way that things have been, either by offering correctives or additions to a religion, or by having brand new ideas being introduced, or by blending ideas from different religions. In fact, America and Japan tend to compete with one another in the production of new religious movements. Sometimes Japan is number one in the production of new religious movements, and sometimes we are. Mm. That fact astonishes my students, who tend to think of Christianity in an extremely narrow sense, for example. I ask them sometimes, and well, often in my classes, to guess how many flavors of Christianity there are. Mm-hmm. And students will say anywhere from maybe a conservative 3 to a couple hundred. Back a few years ago, so I think the numbers changed by now, surely, but back a few years ago, CNN reported that there were 33,820 distinct denominations of Christianity organized under 152 major subheadings.
Is that more than we've ever had? Huge number.
That's a huge number. It's a huge number. It's probably grown since then.
But, I mean, in the course of history, American history, are we at the pinnacle so far of the
yep.
number?
Yes? I would think so.
And what is driving that trend? Why would we expand to greater numbers of groups of sects?
Well, I think one of the things that certainly got the ball rolling was the Protestant Reformation, right? So you have now the idea that that the church, in the sense of church officials and the church hierarchy, has been somewhat erased, and it's you interpreting the text, mm-hmm. right? The authoritative text, the Bible, and you directly communicating with God.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with the Director of Religious Studies at Iowa State University, Nikki Bado. Will be with us, and then coming up later in the hour, we'll have Carolyn Jessup. Triumph is her new book, A Survivor's Story. If you'd like to join our conversation, you worry that someone in your life is involved with a cult, a potentially dangerous sect, share your story, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Back with The Exchange, I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us over this noon hour, Professor Nikki Bado of Iowa State University, Director of Religious Studies there, talking about religious sects and cults. What are they? And are they in our midst? How do we know when they're dangerous? And we want to include your calls in just a moment. A lot of people waiting to get to talk to us on the phone, Professor Bado. But I want to ask you, are there cults, dangerous sects in Iowa, in the Midwest, that you know of?
Hmm. Again, you know, Ben, that really depends on how you define it. For some of the students that come in my classes, I've had students say that Catholicism isn't Christian, and define Catholicism as a cult. Now, you know, I think that's rather pushing the definition. In a hard way, Mormons have, the members of the LDS Church have also come under fire. So have Seventh-day Adventists. So is the Nation of Islam. You know, you can go down the list of American new religious movements and also some that have been around and established for quite a long time, and find that someone somewhere has likely leveled the accusation they're a cult at them. Now, I think one of the things that you need to look at, what are dangerous things, danger signs that are happening, you need to look at to what extent an organization or an institution restricts its members from outside contact, to what extent it controls their money, to what extent it controls their bodies, to what extent it controls who they can marry and have sex with, who they have children with, what's done with their children. I think you need to look at those kinds of material aspects of the institution in order to kind of figure out if it's something that we should be really concerned about or not.
Okay, let's go to our first caller joining us, dialing 1-866-780-9100. Pete is joining us from Cedar Rapids. Good afternoon, Pete.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thank you. I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area in the middle 70s when Jim Jones was active before he went to, I think it was Guyana. I can't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just give you a brief factoid about how they recruited, because they would send people through the neighborhoods and leave little flyers at your doorstep that indicated that they were working for the poor and the oppressed and minorities, and they wanted to help you buy a house. And they had their own banking system, and they would finance people's home purchases, and they even ran a regular press story about this great little movement to help the disadvantaged become homeowners and get out from underneath the tyranny of medieval landlordism. And it was very appealing to me because I was and have been not able really to swing the American capitalist experience in my direction. And so I actually gave it some thought, but I never, at the same time, I just didn't see that it was an appropriate way to do religion was to do it from a financial point of view. So,
And Professor Beto, of course, now we have the Internet. We don't have to rely on flyers. So the Internet, I imagine, is a great recruiting tool.
Oh, sure. Sure it is. It's a good recruiting tool, but there's also the idea that nothing, maybe nothing works as well as offering food to fill somebody's belly or giving them some kind of shoulder to lean on or shoulder to cry on when they're really hurting. And those are really strong incentives. They're strong tools.
And, of course, plenty of worthy organizations that offer those services, too. So who's to know? Michael is in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My personal story is I've got a 8-year-old daughter. She doesn't live with me. She lives with her grandmother, her mother's mother, and they are Jehovah's Witnesses. I know a lot of people don't consider Jehovah's Witnesses to be a cult. I personally, I don't know what my feelings are, really. However, what's happening is I'm getting married in September, and my fiance is Catholic. I'm not Catholic. Her entire family's Catholic. I'm okay with being married to a Catholic. She's okay being married to a non-Catholic, and her entire family is really excited to have me part of the family. Problem we've run into is my daughter's Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall, I guess, or the community that she lives in, they are not allowing her to attend the marriage.
Oh, that's sad.
Because it's being held in a Catholic church, and they feel that would impugn upon their principles to allow her to attend the marriage.
Michael, we understand the situation. I don't know how much advice you can get from our guest today. I don't know, Professor Beto?
That's very sad. I'm very sorry to hear that. Obviously, how old is your daughter again?
She's 8.
She's 8. See, she's not really of an age to probably
to make her
own decision about that and to kind of go against what people are kind of pushing her into doing.
Yeah, well, I guess the reason why I was actually calling in was I was having a discussion with my fiance's mother, and before this conversation, I never really thought of Jehovah's Witnesses as a cult, because I'd been exposed to them earlier because I dated one for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a child together.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was talking to her, she said that she basically gave me the impression that a lot of the Christian faith sees Jehovah's Witnesses as a cult, whereas Jehovah's Witnesses, they see other faiths as a cult. And so I saw a strange dichotomy there.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking earlier about, like, it's really hard to define exactly what is a cult. I guess when I was trying to discuss it with my daughter's grandmother to try and convince them to come out here, I guess I was really trying really hard to not call them a cult. And I was just wondering if you've ever come across that, where it's really hard to, where you've had people who have been in a cult or been in religions that have been openly considered cults, but have either left that or moved on or their cult dispersed. Have you ever, is it really hard to get a person to realize that they're actually in a cult?
Okay, Michael, thanks.
I think that one of the things that's really difficult to do, whether or not a person is in a cult, is to get people to open up and listen to reason, to have a tolerant attitude. You know, maybe the conversation of what would it hurt to have your daughter present at your wedding. You know, that's something that it seems to appeal to reasonable people who are rather open-minded about things, and where you get to kind of dangerous areas past the gray is where you've got the idea of ultimate control, that not even being exposed to something is acceptable, that you have to completely be within the fold.
Mm-hmm. So, and of course, our laws are supposed to protect us from dangerous things, protect citizens.
Right.
And so I imagine it's very difficult for the law, considering we have freedom of religion in this country, and that's a great thing, to protect us from potentially dangerous religions.
One of the things that I talk about in Religions in America when I teach the class is that we have, in this country, we have sets of competing rights. For example, when you think about religious groups that don't believe in going to a doctor for something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the kid falls and breaks his arm, or comes down with you know, some kind of flu or something like that, and they want to administer maybe homeopathic remedies or just pray for their child, rather than taking the child to the doctor. A lot of times, that's when you see a definite clash of rights in America, because we think that, you know, the child has a right to proper care and to proper treatment, and that usually entails reasonable expectations of going to a doctor when the child is ill or when the child has something wrong with them, like a broken arm or something.
Professor Beda, we have to end this discussion. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll have to have you
bad.
Back. This is fascinating.
I'd be glad to be back.
We'd love to have you back, Professor Nikki Beda of the ISU, Director of Religious Studies at Iowa State University. Thank you very much for joining us. We will have
You're
you back.
You're quite welcome.
Fascinating. Coming up in just a moment on The Exchange, as we continue our examination of religious cults and sects, the Carolyn Jessup, author of the 2007 New York Times best-selling memoir, Escape. Her latest book is titled Triumph, Life After the Cult, A Survivor's Lessons. We include your calls as well when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Recently, Iowa's largest physicians association and the Iowa Board of Pharmacy have come out in favor of easing the state's marijuana laws. This will allow researchers to study the drug's usefulness to patients. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about clinical trials with medical marijuana and the debate over whether Iowa should join 14 other states that allow marijuana use for medical purposes. That's tomorrow on The Exchange during the noon hour. In 2003, 35-year-old Carolyn Jessup, a lifelong member of the extremist Mormon sect known as the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the FLDS, gathered up her 8 children in the middle of the night and fled to freedom. She told the story of her harrowing escape and the shocking conditions that sparked it in the 2007 New York Times bestselling memoir, Escape. Carolyn Jessup was able to build a new life for herself after that and her family and enjoy a newfound identity as a successful author. She thought she'd put it all behind her. And then, in April of 2008, it all came roaring back. And you remember this news from the time, I'm sure, acting on a tip from a young girl who'd called a hotline alleging abuse. The state of Texas staged a surprise raid on the Yearning for Zion Ranch. It's a sprawling 1,700-acre compound near El Dorado, Texas. This is where jailed FLDS leader Warren Jeffs had relocated what were called his most worthy members 3 years earlier. And as it turned out, the ranch was being run by Merrill Jessup, Carolyn Jessup's ex-husband. And as we watched the crisis unfold, Carolyn Jessup was called upon by authorities to help them understand this religious sect, the one that they were dealing with. Now, 2 years after that raid, Carolyn Jessup has come out with a new book about that experience. It's called Triumph, Life After the Cult, A Survivor's Lessons. And Carolyn Jessup will be speaking tonight as part of the Avid Author Series, a guest of the Des Moines Public Library, speaking tonight at the Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines at 7 p.m. She joins us this afternoon in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Carolyn Jessup, welcome to our program. We'll get your mic turned up, Carolyn Jessup. What? Remind us what happened in the raid in 2008, how the account that we heard through the news media differs from your account.
Well, a lot of things were never covered because they legally could not put that information out to the public. It involved minors. Some of the things that they also found they could not cover because they were building criminal trials. So they withheld that information from the public. A lot of it was actually held from Child Protective Services as well, which weakened the case that weakened their original case that was eventually overturned by the Supreme Court. And a lot of the reasons the raid really went bad was because not enough of the crime was exposed and not enough was able to be used in the system to protect the kids.
Mm-hmm. What was your role during this raid in the aftermath as well?
My role was actually to try to help the authorities understand what they were dealing with, why they were getting non-cooperation down to four-year-olds saying, I want to speak to my attorney. Mm-hmm. They just had never seen this before. They'd never seen children this programmed in their lives, and they didn't understand what they were dealing with. But what I had to explain to the authorities is these children have been very schooled on how to deal with this type of a situation. They're taught to fast and pray for 3 days sometimes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of discipline that goes on in this group.
And so when you were part of the group, as it seems in this group, it was anticipated that at any point the authorities could come and you were trained to act in a certain way.
You were trained to have perfect obedience to whoever was in charge. And they were sent in with specific instructions as to what to do when they were taken by the authorities. And the authorities in the beginning just could not break through those barriers. They didn't understand what was going on with these children.
Mm-hmm. You say that there was a lot of damaging misinformation that flooded our media in the aftermath of that raid. Give us some examples of the kinds of misinformation that we encountered.
Well, the misinformation is this was a peaceful religious group that were not hurting anyone. Mothers crying their eyes out saying that their children had been taken. What the public didn't see was that most of the mothers that had actually lost their children never appeared on camera. They were too traumatized, and this group was too afraid of what they might say if they did put them on camera. So most of the women that appeared on camera were actually women that were just staged and told what to say, and also were kind of vetted and had more skills in dealing with media. So that was one of the things that the FLDS did. The FLDS are actually pretty good with their PR when they need to be. This is a group that evolved out of the Mormon Church like 120 years ago. And this isn't the first time authorities have cracked down on them. Mm-hmm. So there's generational stories of it. And the fear of the government and outsiders is very entrenched at a very young age. Children are taught to fear anyone that's not from this world. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason the authorities just could not reach the children. They couldn't get to the bottom of what was going on in the beginning. They did pull evidence out of the ranch, though, that did prove their case later.
Explain some of the differences between this sect of the this fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Mormon Church that most of us know. What are the more extreme practices and beliefs that they have that are not in keeping with other Mormons?
Well, this group, it in reality, doesn't even compare to the Mormon Church. There is a big difference between cults and religions. The Mormon Church, I would classify as a religion. And with a religion, you have basic tenets of faith. And those tenets, they stay consistent. And they may evolve over a period of time, but usually it's a long period of time. With a cult, basic tenets of faith can change overnight. They can change by somebody walking in the room and switching on a light switch. It can happen that fast. And basic belief systems can change that quickly. And that's one of the things that make it very dangerous. And it's not about using common sense. It's about perfect obedience and listening to whoever's in charge. So you can't trust what you were taught as a child was right, because the current leadership may have changed it to where now that is wrong.
The FLDS also believes and practices polygamy. You were one of six wives.
Yes, I was.
Of course, you have your ex-husband. We can talk about that in a few minutes. Is polygamy necessarily a bad thing in your view?
I didn't have a good experience with polygamy. One of the elements that, to me, doesn't make it work is that when you have a relationship that involves two people, you have the potential for some balance in the relationship. When you get more than that involved in a relationship, the balance can become rather scary. And if you get more than one member of the relationship ganging up on another, there's just very, very unhealthy elements that can occur. One of the largest conflicts I have with polygamy currently is that it is not regulated in this country, and there are no laws really specifically to protect victims that are born into this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's primarily ignored. And the reality is the group that I escape from is the largest closed polygamous community within the Western United States, and it has memberships of over 10,000. However, there are many, many closed polygamous communities and many independents. Utah alone has over 80,000 polygamists. This is not just a unique lifestyle. It's spreading through the Western United States, and there are many problems associated with this lifestyle. And some of those are that there's just not any kinds of regulations to regulate it. People don't know how to deal with it. And the victims don't have anywhere to go for help.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the popularization of polygamy through shows such as Big Love? I don't know if you've seen that.
I have seen that. I think that it can be damaging because people start seeing it as a normal way to live. And that show doesn't expose enough of the types of crimes that actually occur in this lifestyle. However, the upside of the show is it is getting it out to the public that it exists. And sometimes you have to expose this type of a lifestyle or something that's different like this to people in a way that is palatable, that they will actually watch, they will actually pay attention to. However, I do think there needs to be some follow-up and some explanation to people that it's not as good as it looks in Big Love. It doesn't work that way in reality.
If you just joined us, my guest is Carolyn Jessup. Triumph is her latest book, Life After the Cult, The Survivor's Lessons. Carolyn was born into the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, an extremist Mormon sect, and she spent most of her life in Colorado City, Arizona, the main base of the FLDS. Since fleeing that sect in 2003, she's lived in Utah with her children. Now, going back to that raid, there was one of the problems that you point to in the raid and that aftermath was the Supreme Court of Texas's decision to allow the children in state custody to return to their parents. What was the reasoning there?
Well, it went back to the removal. When the authorities went into the ranch and they started interviewing these children, they found some very alarming crimes. They found crimes that matched identical the complaints that from the phone call. And they found some other crimes that were incredibly concerning.
Which were, to list them?
Which were that parents were on that. I mean, there were children on that ranch that were not there with parents. Some of them said that their father had been excommunicated from the group and they hadn't seen him for many, many years. They'd been separated from their mother and they had no idea where she was. And they were not allowed to talk to her and told that they would never be able to speak to her again. The number of children that did not have parents on that ranch was very alarming. And when it was compounded with the types of crimes that they were finding with the minor girls being sexually abused, they were very concerned. Then to make matters worse, they found military-grade weapons on the ranch, a lot of them. Some of it involved ammunition and ways to take out a tank. Yes. So I think the state had some concerns of another Waco, and they ruled on the side of caution, get the kids off the ranch. So the orders came down from Texas and Child Protective Services. It came down from Austin, and they said, get them all off. So they removed the children without making an individual case on every single child, which was impossible at the time due to the circumstances and the concerns where they needed to remove them immediately.
And when returned, they were returned with good reason, you think?
No, they were not. And the Supreme Court decision left Child Protective Services with the options of actually still having a case on these children and taking them back into state custody if they found reason. However, the whole situation had spiraled into such chaos for them. I believe when Austin sent the orders, they thought they were sending orders to remove 60 kids. Well, they removed 439.
Wow.
And they just didn't have the resources to deal with how many children they had to take care of. So it immediately spiraled into a very unpleasant situation, which just grew out of control and became very ugly. And then with the bad publicity in the media, and they didn't have any way to protect themselves, I think CPS wanted to just wash their hands of the whole thing and move on, which in my opinion is pretty much what they did. And what's been so tragic to me is that now that they're prosecuting these men for hurting these girls, my stepson just recently in March was given 75 years for what he did to a minor. I think the thing that's the most painful for me, though, isn't just that he hurt a minor that way. It's that this victim is not receiving any help, and neither are the two children he fathered with her.
You point in your book, and you're referring to it, that some of the successes of the raid, the evidence seized in the raid leading to a string of criminal trials. You're referring to one of them right now. They're continuing even this year. In fact, your ex-husband, Merrill Jessup, has been charged with marrying his 12-year-old daughter to Warren Jeffs, the FLDS prophet, who was in his 50s at the time. Is that also not one of your children that's referred to, the 12-year-old daughter? Or is it a child of another woman?
It's a child of another one of his wives.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the very thing that I was concerned or alarmed about at the time I left. I was very concerned that I couldn't protect my oldest daughter that was turning 14. I think one of the more traumatic things for me at the raid was just realizing how bad it got after I left, how young these girls started being hurt. And then, of course, seeing a minor hurt like that I had contributed to raising her. It was just, it was very, very traumatic. And my children, I think that when they were watching this all unfold on TV, they were seeing their half-siblings in custody, and they did see pictures of them. And we went through a period of time in our family where there wasn't a day that they didn't thank me for getting them out of that. I think they actually, at that point, started understanding what could have happened to them if I wouldn't have made that run I did mm-hmm. in the night.
Whereas if you would have asked them point blank at the point of being removed from that, they would have had a different response.
Oh, absolutely. It was it was incredibly difficult for my kids to leave that religion because it was all they knew. They were very close to their half-siblings. They didn't hardly know each other because that's the way the children were raised in a family. They were raised communally. And so when I took them, I wasn't able to take anybody but mine. And so they were separated from their half-siblings that they were very, very close to. And then they were put into a public school for the first time in their life, and they had to face a lot of challenges that they didn't know were there. They are very happy now. We did have some struggles in the beginning with some of the adjustments. And I think that right at the beginning, they really couldn't understand what I was doing, and they didn't understand why.
Mm-hmm. What help us understand, because, of course, most of us have never been targeted by this type of group, or as you did, you were born into this group. The nature of the control that the FLDS exercises on its members, how can that be so extreme?
It's difficult to understand. My oldest daughter, Betty, did return, the daughter that I was running, trying to protect. And you really can't understand why she went back without understanding the mind control. she felt like that being with me meant that she was going to hell. She felt like if she chose to be with her father, that meant she was going to heaven. But the mind control in this particular group is very, it's very different than even in other cults because you're born into it. You never have exposure other than this. And it's generational. I'm six generations of polygamy. And so there's not anything to contradict what you're being told. It appears normal because it's all you know. And then you're told that anything different than this is so much worse. The other element with this group is they do not convert. They do not go out and target new members.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not born into this group, then you would never be a member of the FLDS. So you don't have new bloodlines coming in. You don't have new ways of thinking. It's a very closed society. You're related to nearly every member of the community. Anyone within the community as a child has a right to discipline you or correct you. And we would refer, when I was a child, we referred to all adults as aunts or uncles. And in many cases, they were our aunt or our uncle because we were so intermarried and so related. So you have the intermarriage, which is one element of the mind control, just because you don't have a lot of other concepts ever being exposed. Then you're living and growing up in a very rural, isolated community, and you rarely are exposed to the outside world, and you're taught at a very early age to be terrified of it.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn Jessup is my guest. In the last 5 minutes of our conversation, Triumph, her latest book, Life After the Cult, A Survivor's Lessons, speaking tonight at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines at 7 p.m. as a guest of the Des Moines Public Library. So what were the sources of strength that allowed you, Carolyn Jessup, to survive and eventually break free of the FLDS when so many others haven't?
Well, I think for me, one of my key sources of strength were my children and the desire to protect them. And I had a breaking point when my son was diagnosed with cancer, and my husband, or ex-husband now, he turned against me and brutalized me with the family pressure to let him die. And the FLDS, they're really quite opposed to medical. I mean, they do use it some, but it's kind of a taboo situation. And I was insisting on medical care for my son. I had to take on everything I'd ever believed in, everything I'd ever been exposed to, and be willing to throw it all away to save my son's life.
Have you ever been in danger since leaving the FLDS from the group, threatened by the group at all?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm testifying in a lot of these trials, and they have sent word up that either I better stop it, or I'm going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do send out threats. They are a violent group. I just have the philosophy that you have to use a little bit of common sense and not be overly paranoid, but not be stupid either.
In your book, and we can't talk about it at length, we have just a couple minutes left, but you talk about a hidden radio and a talk show psychologist as helping you at this time. I'd like for you to offer some advice to listeners who may be concerned about a family member being involved in some sort of dangerous religious group. What are some of the red flags that you can point to when it comes to identifying a dangerous religious group?
The first red flag I would point out is isolation. If this group is trying to isolate your loved one away from family members, especially away from you, you need to pay attention. There's a problem. There's a real purpose in isolation, either in whatever method it's being practiced, if it's that they're trying to put them in a rural area, or if they're just trying to get them to give up their former friends and family and other associates.
Mm-hmm. And it's not good enough reason to say we want to keep our religious practice pure. That is a rationale that's used.
And that I would be so skeptical of. If they want to isolate somebody from family members, there is a problem. I would say almost 100% of the time. Regardless of the rationale, there is a problem. I mean, what God wants to take a child away from their parents? That doesn't make any sense.
So what would you do as a loved one with a family member who is in a suspect group? How would you check it out?
There's actually some pretty good materials out there for this kind of thing. Stephen Hansen actually is involved. I mean, his book was one of the better books that I've read. If you check it out on the internet, you can find some resources of the warning signs. They're really quite technical. And if you actually believe you do have a family member getting involved in a controlling group that has cult-like tendencies, I would recommend strongly professional help and get it from somebody that knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any dangerous groups, religious groups, active in the Midwest, in Iowa, as you come here to visit?
You know, I'm not with specifics. The one thing that I would put out there that I think in America, that we need to be aware of in America, is that cults are on the rise. They are growing. They're not something to be taken lightly. And people need to get educated to what they are, and they need to pay attention if they're moving into a location near them. Most cults do recruit. That's where they get their members. And if you have a family member who is in a weak place in their life, that's where you need to watch closely, because that's where cults, that's when they're open to be recruited into a cult. Another area of age that's a concern is the age between 18 and 24, especially if the individual is struggling with any kind of problems. They could be at risk to be converted into a cult.
Carolyn Jessup, thank you very, very much for joining us this afternoon, and thank you for visiting Iowa.
Thank you.
Carolyn Jessup will be speaking tonight as part of the AVID author series, a guest of the Des Moines Public Library at Hoyt Sherman Place in Des Moines at 7 p.m. She is author of her latest book, Escape, her former book, her latest, Triumph, Life After the Cult, The Survivor's Lessons. And Carolyn Jessup joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Our producer assistant today, Christina Sarnelli. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.